Welcome to Not Quite Magic, a podcast about interpreters. I'm Elena Langdon, and for this second season, I'm talking to a variety of interpreters around the world about AI and its role or place in interpreting. I'm happy to say we are sponsored by the Masterword Institute, where you can find training and testing for interpreters and those who work with them. Check out their offerings at masterword.institute. For this first episode of the season, I interviewed Jamie Russell, an English-Spanish interpreter based in Raleigh, North Carolina. Most of her work has been in healthcare settings, and she's heavily involved in professional associations. Jamie also recently made an exciting change in her career. Let's listen to her story. Well, welcome, Jamie. I'm so happy to have you here as we restart Not Quite Magic and launch this season that's dedicated to AI or machine interpreting. So thank you again for accepting my invitation.
No, thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be here with you this morning.
So I'll start with the first question that I usually ask, which is based on the name of the podcast. So what does seem like magic to you?
So I was thinking about this a little bit this morning, and the first thing that popped into my mind was it's definitely magic how you can be in almost any corner of the world within a matter of 1, 2, 3 days. And that is something that if you were to ask somebody from the past about this, that would be complete magic. And I still find it mind-boggling. So,
yeah, I agree with you on that. Every time I fly, I still think, like, how did they figure this out?
Yeah.
And how are we not falling from the sky?
Exactly.
So thank you for that. What is the short version of what you tell your potential clients about what you do?
So it will depend a little bit on the client. So if it's somebody who I can tell has had no exposure to language or translating and interpreting, I will first start off saying I'm a Spanish translator and interpreter, because that word translator resonates a lot more with the general public than the word interpreter does. And if someone has heard interpreter before, it might be for American Sign Language. So that's how I start out. I say I'm a Spanish translator and interpreter. I help people get their message into the other language and vice versa.
Nice. That's a good short version. It's interesting because I find myself doing the same thing with using the word translator. And if it's a really quick exchange, so it's not a potential client, let's say an Uber driver or something, mm-hmm. sometimes I only say translator, mm-hmm. I have to say, for very much the same reason, you know, that term interpreter is not always what people recognize as, mm-hmm. you know, like, what does that mean? And if you do want to invite more questions, then sure. But if you're trying to get it out quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And putting it first too, right? Translator uh-huh. and interpreter. And yep. then there might be a little bit of an indication of what that is.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So what is the longer version? Like, can you tell us a little bit about how you got started, what your work looks like, any evolution, any changes? I know that you've gone through some pretty big ones recently. And then what a typical work week looks like for you right now.
So the longer version is very long. Sometimes I do a kind of an elevator pitch where people ask me, well, how did you get into that? How did you become a translator and interpreter? So I have come up with sort of a summarized version of I'm originally from the Washington, D.C. area, born and raised there, a semester abroad in Argentina during college, ended up being 15 years. I graduated university in Argentina, and I started working as a freelance translator, handling documents from Spanish into English for a bunch of different agencies, a lot of them based in Argentina, but other international agencies. Moved back to the US in 2010, worked in international nonprofits and philanthropy for a while, because of my Spanish skills. 2019, I decided to exit that sector and go back to translating. And that's when I ran into the machine translation world. I had known about it, but I hadn't worked in it a lot. And that was jarring. In the DC area, that was unfortunately not enough income. And so one of the agencies I worked for as a translator, I was working as a medical translator for a lot of clinical trial documentation, and that's a whole other world. And they asked me if I wanted to explore doing medical interpreting assignments. I said, sure. I love to talk. Love, love, love to talk. And then I figured, oh, wow, I can get paid for talking. And so that's how I ended up in interpreting. So I was doing that for a while. The pandemic hit. Everything was crazy. I didn't have a single job for 2 months. DC mortgage was still knocking on my door. So my sister lives here in North Carolina, where I currently live. And she was like, y'all need to move down here. Cost of living is much cheaper. So I applied for a job as a Spanish interpreter at UNC Health Hospital in Chapel Hill. A lot of people have heard of UNC because of basketball. It's a big deal. I didn't know about it that much until I applied for the job there. I got the job very quickly. They were in dire need of interpreters. So I started working there as a full-time staff interpreter at the hospital. It's amazing. It's an amazing profession. You see things, you're able to help people. It's so very interesting and stimulating. It is very tiring as well. Long days, very intense days. The cognitive load on an interpreter is enormous. And then you have emotional loads on top of that with difficult situations. So last year, I was promoted to the education specialist at UNC for our department for interpreter services. Lots of trainings, lots of educating staff members on language access. And very recently, I decided to decrease my hours at the hospital and go back to freelancing. So I started out as a freelancer, then I was a staff interpreter, and now I'm going back to freelancing. And I'm hoping to add on some more teaching opportunities and court interpreting. That's my big next project. So my typical work week is crazy. I'm in a mix between hospital duties and freelance duties.
Well, thank you. That is a lot. I feel like a lot of us in the field do a lot. I feel like a lot of us women do a lot. And even the culture in general, right? We all are like, everything's crazy. I want to touch upon a few things that you said because I know of some of the differences in terms of training and the education and even the profession around translation in Argentina and other South American countries that I'm aware of. And I think it's somewhat similar in Europe, right? So where you have in Brazil, it's called a tradutor juramentado. Don't know if it's juramentado in Spanish or not, but it's an official profession. You get appointed by the Chamber of Commerce. And you, because of the legal system there that's much more based on written documents, at least used to be. I think it is changing a little bit right now, but primarily you're a translator, but you also are an interpreter in this official capacity. And you can't even get that, you can't get nominated for the position, at least in Brazil, again, in the past. When I was living there, it was in 2000 to 2003. When I live there again. And so maybe things have changed. But at the time, I couldn't even apply for it because I wasn't born in Brazil. You had to be born. Even if I had become a Brazilian citizen, I couldn't do it. You had to
Oh,
be born.
interesting.
Yeah. You know, as they say in Portuguese, natural from that country. And I could you talk a little bit about that? Like you were in college, did you get a degree in the field, or how was it to interact? And then the change when you came back to the States for that profession, because it's, well, let me hear what you have to say about
Sure.
it. Thank you.
Yeah, so in Argentina, translators are so you actually have to have a university degree in that, and then in order to legally act as a translator and to handle official documentation, you have to register with different sort of professional bodies. There, you can't just like go out on your own and then call yourself a translator. And Argentina has a lot of those professional bodies for different professions. So a lot of the engineering bodies have their own associations. Even if you want to be like a business person, just own businesses, open businesses, you don't have to officially be associated with the business body that's through the Chamber of Commerce, but most people are. It's a testament to kind of your dedication to the profession. And it does provide you certain legal protections if something were to happen. So, regarding the profession of translator in Argentina, and it's very demanding and it's very highly esteemed. So, it's a full university degree, usually 5 years through the university system. And then when you get out, you have to take some tests and present all your paperwork to be able to be accepted into these professional associations. Now, when I was in Argentina, I was working as a freelancer. So in Argentina, when you get a university degree in translation, it is from English or French or Italian or German into Spanish. So that's what it conveys. My native language is English. So a lot of these agencies would need things from Spanish into English. So a lot of the official translators, los traductores públicos, either couldn't do it because of the limitations of their university degree or their association kind of a profile. So that's when the agencies would contact me. And as you know, in this field, translators are expected to translate into their native language for different reasons, mainly because it's more natural, the flow is better, word choice matches up a little bit better. I have some opinions on that, but I can completely understand why that is. I don't think personally I would feel comfortable translating very long, maybe complex documents into Spanish. Again, English is my native language. So, I was a pure freelancer in Argentina, making good money in Argentina because I worked for some US agencies who would pay me in dollars. So it's a pretty good gig I had going on. And then when I came back up to the US market is very unregulated. There might be certain agencies, government agencies that require, for example, ATA certification or a university degree or some other testing that they might give specific to their agency that you have to pass. But for the most part, anybody can call themselves a translator and an interpreter, and there's really not much that can be done about it, unfortunately. So I was still freelancing when I came back up to the US, but the rates at that time just were not ideal. So that's how I got into the nonprofit sector.
Yeah, thank you. You're so right about the differences in the market, especially from that regulatory viewpoint. I think, and the general, even the respect and the recognition of it as a profession, right? Because as you said, here in the United States, and I think it's one of the few places that it's like that, anybody can call themselves a translator or an interpreter. And when the whole idea of a gig economy really took hold, it was because of that, one of the professions that just kind of went there. Maybe not professions, I should say, but one of the fields or one of the jobs that people thought were conveniently made sense to do it. And it's a fight that we've all been in, right? And through associations, through certifying bodies, through a little bit of lobbying that happens, there should, I'd always like for there to be more, but for us to be recognized as a profession and really have a lot more regulation around it. Think of that. And this is, for people who aren't aware, You don't need a degree. You don't need anything. In most other countries, you do. One of the only difference really in the States is for ASL interpreters, for American Sign Language interpreters. Same thing, right? They need a college degree in that. And given the importance and the risk of everything that we touch, for the most part, still baffles my mind how we don't have that.
Well, and also, I also do evaluations and training and things like that. And it's extremely common for people to overestimate their language skills. So it's like it's a double whammy almost, because you have anybody can just call themselves a translator and interpreter, and most people overestimate their language proficiency. So as a potential client, you're really walking in blind as to that person's credentials and their true skills. On the flip end, for example, and this is my case, right now I've have all sorts of credentials and sort of proof of my language skills. But if I had to have a university degree, that would have been extremely limiting for me in my professional career. And a lot of people in our field start out in something different. Finance, law, you know, we have a lot of people in common who are lawyer linguists. For example, a lot of MDs who immigrate from other countries, they cannot practice medicine here in the United States, but then they go into medical interpreting and they're very highly successful. So, in that sense, it is nice to have an open door for professionals who truly have the skills to continue on and formalize their skills, but at the same time, those are the exceptions. So I don't know. I have conflicting feelings about that, because in my case, if somebody would have been like, "Well, where's your university degree?" that would have ended it. I would have had to go on to something different. I would have had to go on to the business administration degree I got in Argentina, be doing something completely different.
Yeah, you're right. The rigidity of it, because it can be very rigid in other places, would be definitely a downside to it. So that flexibility afforded by capitalism and all the other market regulations, I guess it just needs to be the work that we continue to do at associations and other places that can hope to have some influence, right? And
Correct,
bringing
yeah.
us together as a profession and as professionals more and more with with teaching, with training, anything that when someone starts working as an interpreter, they can then be part of something that's actually a profession and not just a
Exactly.
job.
And know about it as well, because a lot of people act as translators or interpreters for years, years before they even hear of the associations or credentialing bodies. And that seems a bit odd to me, but it's very common.
Yes, for sure. One other thing I wanted to touch upon in terms of what you said before is the emotional load. So I love the way you termed how there's a cognitive load, which people who've studied interpreting have heard of, and this idea of an emotional load. So if you could talk a little bit more about that transition from translation to interpreting and that kind of with that kind of a light or a focus.
Sure. So, as a translator, you work behind the scenes. Lots of times you actually have no contact whatsoever with either the end client or the target audience that your text will be, aimed at. So you're kind of like a mystery writer a little bit, I would say. And it's very easy to separate yourself out from that. I think translators probably get emotionally involved with their end product that they're about to deliver. We've all had it where you turn in a project and you're never really convinced. You're never 100% convinced. There's always that one sentence or that one term that's still like bugging your brain a little bit. And then you wake up at 3 in the morning and it's like bing, right? Oh my gosh, I should have put that in. So that is, but that's sort of a very internal load. And then I think as you progress in your profession, you learn to kind of get over that a little bit. But when you're interpreting, especially in community interpreting, which is a little bit different from conference interpreting, Community interpreting is you are involved, heavily involved right there with the people you're serving. So the people who are benefiting from your language skills are sitting right next to you. They're listening to your voice. And it goes this other way as well. So there's, people crying, people yelling, babies being born. This is all in the hospital setting, but there, in the school setting, you could have some children who have some severe learning delays and they're not making progress, and it's very frustrating for the family. So that emotional part for us as human beings is hard. Also, in the community setting, I don't know if it's good or bad, but it is what it is. Lots of times we're expected to be more than an excuse me, more than an interpreter. So we're kind of expected to be a liaison, helping people navigate different systems. I was giving a class last week, and one of my students gave me an example of something that she'll never forget. And it wasn't exactly the interpreting, but she met somebody at the door and was walking them back through the hallways to the room that they were supposed to go into. She said this poor lady unloaded on her all of the details of her divorce. And then they walked into the room and she's just supposed to kind of delete all of that, just annul all of that in her brain. And we've had, excuse me, that is the emotional load that we carry. And also because the communication, we have a burden of making sure the communication is as accurate as possible. So if you're a new interpreter or maybe you're in a new situation, there's also that worry of, oh my gosh, what if I say something that's maybe wrong, maybe not the best way to say it? What if I misunderstand something? So, and once it's out, like you don't have a chance to correct it. You can, but a lot of times it's already out. The words have come out. The other person has heard them that way. And if you need to make a correction, you might not actually realize until a few sentences later. And by that time, it's like ancient history, what you said 5 sentences prior. So there's that emotional load. Some people who work in delicate settings, complicated settings, like they might go home or they might go to their car and like cry. I've personally never had that happen. My mother was a nurse in a hospital for 45 years, so I think she jaded me a little bit with her stories. But I definitely can see how it's a burden. And in the court system, somebody's freedom could potentially be at risk, or depending on the state where you live, their life could be at risk as well. And, if we're in charge of the communication. So that's what I was referring to when I said the emotional burden.
Yeah, so well put. In your example of the woman who unloaded the whole story of her divorce, there's that emotional load, all the things that are now going on in the background for the interpreter. And also what I've found is that then the person who's talked to you about this kind of expects, as would be expected in normal relationships when you're talking to someone, that that's going to affect how they talk about you or how they see you, and
Correct.
sometimes wanting the or expecting the interpreter, even just so unconsciously expecting the interpreter to fill in things. Or I'm sure you've gotten the comment from a patient saying, oh, well, you can just tell him I just told you about it, or as I was telling you, or even I have actually felt that the person isn't saying more because they're assuming that I'm going to fill in the blanks. And that recommendation of don't be alone with the patient is great, but it doesn't work in practice in
Correct,
many
yeah.
instances. So it's, how do you navigate that? And yes, the emotional burden or the emotional load can be quite high. And I'm grateful that within the last 5, 10 years, we've been talking so much more about this for interpreters and vicarious trauma and how it happens for interpreters and what are the strategies, what are the things that we can do to mitigate it and to help even in the moment, right? So that you can stay focused
Correct.
on the content.
And this question does come up, as we're not supposed to be left alone with the people we're serving, but it happens, or we're walking out and they grab you. And from a human perspective, I will always offer up help to direct them to someone else. So, if somebody's saying, "Oh my gosh, my divorce, I just got served with papers yesterday or something like that. I don't know what to do. My life is falling apart." Some comforting words in the moment just to acknowledge. Lots of times people just want to be heard. They don't necessarily want you to do something about it, but they want to be heard. So just acknowledgement of, "Oh my gosh, that's so difficult. I can't imagine what you're going through." And that's not going to change your interpreting interaction later on. And then if you realize that this person as another human being could use further help, you could, like this, for example was in a school setting. You could offer up something like, would it help if after we finish, we go find the school social worker who can maybe provide you with some more resources? We can ask her. Maybe there's some community resources out there. So listen and then redirect that potential need to another professional.
Yeah, thank you for that, because it again, it's another thing that I find that new interpreters or students can kind of go either way. Sometimes it's too extreme where they're like, no, I can't do anything. I'm just the interpreter. I'm just there to interpret, and so I don't say anything. For a couple of years as part of an exam that I had in a longer course, like a semester long or a year long course, I was seeing that the answers to a midterm about what would you do if somebody came and told you, for example, that they were a victim of domestic abuse and they were in a bad situation with their spouse. And an alarmingly high number, this is after the whole semester talking about some of these issues, along with all the other issues about interpreting and the technical skills, an alarmingly high number of them would say, well, I can't do anything. And, I would just not do anything. I'm not doing anything. And just like you said, thinking about it from the human perspective, thinking about it in that situation, so many times the person is only going to say it once. And, it can take months, years for women to come forth with something like that. Your story about the divorce is a little bit different, but at the same time, it really isn't. And it's a good example to show that above all, yes, we're humans trying to connect. And the only way, in my opinion, to truly connect, to truly communicate is to connect. And if there isn't that connection, so let's say this does happen before or even after you've interpreted, but you will see the person later on at some point, or even you won't, but another interpreter will, and you just dismiss it completely and appear to be completely insensitive, there is that chance that now they're like, okay, these interpreters are really not, again, this is probably all at the unconscious level, but the interpreters are not, there is no connection. They don't care. They don't care about me, right? And if you think somebody doesn't care, you're not going to share as much. You're not going to be open, right? The rapport is lost. And even though we want the main rapport to be between the provider and the patient, or the teacher and the student, or the teacher and the family, the two people who are having the conversation, there needs to be some with the interpreter as well.
Of course, yeah. And you don't want to be that interpreter that when you arrive and excuse me, the patient or the family's like, "Ugh, I got this one again." No,
Yeah.
you want to be the one where they're like, "Oh, thank God you're here."
Right.
Right? Yeah.
And then, of course, the fine line of, you don't want to be the one who's also buying them things and driving them
Oh, yeah.
around. And that's the whole the crux of when you're teaching is, how could we nuance this well enough? And I think it's something that a lot of people who work in other settings don't really understand and sometimes think, oh, well, healthcare interpreters, you can be really flexible and provide all this support. It's like, well, no, when you're interpreting, but when there's something that happens on the outside and we try to avoid it, but
Of course.
inevitably it happens,
Yeah.
then you can still be human. And redirecting them is always the way to go. It's like, I can't personally help you, but let me take you to somebody who can, and I'll interpret for that.
Exactly. And also many times the people who we serve are struggling on so many different levels. And if you in language, so if they can't speak the language of the places where they need to acquire the services, and if you can at least help them with that aspect of it, that's a huge help. That's a huge help to them. And they're and you're not changing anything. You're not changing the relationship. You're not setting unrealistic expectations. Again, listen and then redirect. And it's something very easy for us to do. And it's still, I think, within our professional role.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Well, this is what is usually the initial first part has been a wonderful discussion. I want to move on a little bit to the topic for the season, which is AI. What I like to think of or like to talk about as machine interpreting, because it's not really AI in the end. I mean, AI is part of it, but because of the how enamored people are with AI, to be really frank with my opinion, it's just that's what people talk about. So we can use the buzzword, but what it really comes down to is machine interpreting, and that's to use that term is to pair it with machine translation, which you already actually addressed. So what has your relationship been with machine interpreting, which has really it's been on the scene for a couple of years before even chat with a f very few players, but now it's much more in the public awareness, and just lay people in general talk about AI for interpreting. So how has that been for you?
Well, so I mostly work in the hospital setting, and right now it's not present in the hospital settings, at least not officially. And that is because I think there's still a lot of unanswered questions regarding HIPAA, legalities, liabilities, all of that sort of stuff. Now, my exposure to machine or AI interpreting, I've watched a bunch of like webinars and demos and things like that. All of the, how can I put it this way? I think all of those are more controlled environments, and the demos I've seen have usually been for speeches, like one way, like what a conference interpreter might do, not so much for the dialogue environment where you have people talking at the same time, people talking over each other, different noises going on. You might have somebody speaking English but with a foreign accent, things like that. So when I have viewed these demos, I keep think a lot of them are really good, right? Like scary good. But then
Yes,
I keep
yes.
thinking that's a completely different environment from the environment I work in. So I don't know how they would actually successfully transfer over into a more community interpreting setting. Like if people get bad news or they're upset, they're talking kind of while they're crying. And they might like put their tissue over their face and but they're still talking at the same time. And I think because the AI doesn't have the context of what's going on, communication is so contextual. Human communication is so contextual, which is different from translation as well. So translation is written, it's been thought out, polished, edited, all that sort of stuff. So for AI to take over translation, and we've already seen it, it's really good on a lot of different levels, but that's not the way people talk. So I don't know what's going to end up happening in a few years. Maybe it will get really good, but I also, with my colleagues, we talk. And so part of what I do at the hospital is I do annual evals for actual interpreting, and everybody has their style. Everybody might choose a term for X situation and then use a different term in a different situation. And it's all okay. It's all accurate interpreting. And so, and they also pick up on how the original speakers are speaking, and they adjust their communication to that situation, to that speaker, to that mood a little bit. And I just have a hard time imagining how a machine is going to accurately render all of that nuance that goes on into the conversation. I don't know, it might get there, but I'm telling you, when you have a pediatric appointment and the mom's trying to talk and the baby's like fussy and the baby's on her lap and like starting to fuss and make all these little noises, and I'm like, no machine can do that.
I think that no machine can really capture human communication because of the nature of it. And you touched on a lot of that. I mean, translation, written translation is one way, and it is a little bit more about, a code that's being transferred from one language to another. And if you do have enough data, which now we're reaching the point where I think there is a lot of data for certain languages, for certain language pairs, you can do it quite well. You can do it very, very well with, with human revision that, again, because of the timing of it and everything, can still happen. And it can save time. I think it can save, and I'm seeing it saving time and in new fields. I used to think of it, well, yeah, it's, instruction manuals for appliances. 25 years ago, machine translation was probably pretty good. It was doing, and of course, who reads instruction manuals? Small percentage of the population. But now I think even with other fields it's working, or other particular types of documents. Whereas, like you said, with interpreting, it can be quite different. And so what I've seen with interpreting is that because of the nature of the communication is quite different, right? And a lot of, if you look at communication theory itself, it talks about it being dynamic. It talks about the meaning is co-created. It's created in the moment. It's not static. So as you talk and the other person hears that and sees you and considers the past information that they have as a human, they are interpreting what's being said and they're now responding to it. So you're co-creating things as you go. So there's that aspect of it that I think is going to be quite difficult for machines to do well. And there's the further aspect of it, which is who likes communicating with chatbots. I mean, I don't know anybody who gets on the phone to call
My
to make an
God.
appointment or anything, and it's like, oh, I'm thrilled that I'm now talking to an automated voice system, right? Everybody, I mean, I get angry every single time. I can't, there is no way. I have a really hard time imagining it, that I'm going to go to a doctor's appointment or a school meeting with the teacher of my children or the court or any of these settings and be okay with the fact that I'm not talking to a human. I'm having, I'm talking to a machine and I'm getting back an automated generated voice and one that it just, I can't, I can't imagine it. But of course, there's a lot in our world that, me personally, I don't want to imagine. I don't, personally want to imagine, and I already have an issue with. You know, if I go to, which I don't really go to very much, but let's say I occasionally go to fast food, and now I'm, you know, I have to order with the screen. And there are people there, and I don't understand why am I forced to order this from a screen.
Well, yeah, it is a little bit, things are progressing, things change. But regarding interpreting and the use of AI in interpreting, one thing that has really caught my attention, because I tinker around with different AI models, mostly ChatGPT, but it doesn't know when it's wrong. So you can ask it questions and it gets it wrong. And then when you call it out on that, it's like, oh, sorry. And then it provides you another. It's sort of like it's throwing stuff out to see what sticks. So in interpreting, if it's getting it wrong, it's not going to know that it's getting it wrong. Whereas we as humans, if we hear something and we're like, wait a second, but that doesn't make sense. That doesn't make sense either the words coming out or the context or what's going on. As community interpreters, which is would be different from maybe conference interpreting, we have the ability to ask questions to dig a little bit deeper. But AI is not going to be able to do that in an encounter. So it could potentially spit out something incorrect and nobody knows that it's incorrect. And then you might have, so for Spanish, a lot of people, Spanish speakers understand different degrees of English. So they might be able to say, no, that's not what I meant. Or we have a lot of staff members at the hospital who also speak Spanish to different degrees, and so they can understand a little bit of the conversation. So if you get to the point where you realize AI is incorrect on something and you say, hey, I'm not sure that that's what the patient meant to say, I think like you're going to flip it out. I don't know if AI is going to know what to do in that situation. So what I potentially see as a realistic possibility for the future AI in community interpreting settings is for there to be a human revisor listening in basically to that conversation. For me, I'd rather be interpreting than listening, but you know, it might be good enough. Or there might be what I also kind of foresee happening is a future demand being put on, for example, in a hospital setting, certain standard questions that you have to ask in a certain way. So then the AI can interpret it correctly and accurately. And then let's hope that the patient will answer in a pretty standardized fashion as well, which I don't know, that kind of takes out a lot of the human aspect of the interpreting. We're people, we like to talk to each other. And no, you're right. Nobody likes to talk to a chatbot. And so what happens when you're forced to engage with a chatbot? Something goes wrong. Like, do you, is there like a button going to be at the bottom of the screen or something? Like, you know how when you call the bank and you can't get through, and this is what I do. I'm just like customer service. And I just keep repeating that or say operator. Is there going to be a button at the bottom of a screen for you to like be like, I'm done with the AI stuff. This is a nightmare. Let's get a real person on. Maybe. You know, that's quite possible. Because I also don't see if you're going to have a live human revisor or editor or listener in that moment, you're still going to have to pay that person to be listening.
Which
And
is I've heard that idea that, you know, will be the profession or the task really will be to revise, to edit, or, you know, to input when it's wrong. But it's the same thing that you said. Well, who's gonna do that? Nobody's gonna do it for free, so maybe it'll lower the price. So then now we have somebody with a lot less skill who's doing it. But then if that person with less skill, because you know, they're getting paid so little, we're not going to get somebody who's actually has a lot of skill, then what's the point? Because they're not going to be able to actually check it.
Correct, yeah.
I can't even imagine doing that, which a lot of people don't want to do, you know, don't want to revise, don't want to edit machine translated. material either, but in interpreting it just seems even more that it just doesn't seem to make sense.
Yeah,
And
I agree with you on that.
how would you, it wouldn't really save time. There would always have to be that option. Probably most people would opt for it. It reminds me also of that idea that, oh, I know some Spanish, so let me, I'll speak to the patient, and then if I get something wrong, you tell me. It's like, well, how do I know what you wanted to say? I don't know that you wanted to say kidney versus liver, you know, or whatever, or, you know, just to talk about basic words,
Yeah.
you know, not much less the things that are more complicated.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I remember listening to one of the presentations that Catherine Allen gave early on about machine interpreting, and after that, thinking, I think the role for providers could potentially really change too, where they're giving less information and less, yeah, there's less information that's being passed on verbally because this can all be translated ahead of time, or not even translated, sorry, transmitted to the patient in whatever language ahead of time, right? So that we will, you know, we'll go to a kiosk and we'll enter all of our information about, you know, past history or whatever, and then it's going to give us some basic stuff. Or if, you know, I'm di these are my numbers, and it's like, okay, you're diabetic, here's your treatment, here's the video, learn how to do it, right? I think that's very likely to happen. I think it's gonna suck. I don't want to participate in that kind of society, but anyway, it could happen. But the optimist in me was thinking maybe there'll be a role for providers to then go back to what they used to do, which is offering connection and comfort and a sense of care. And maybe that's what the interpreter would end up being there for.
Yeah, it's quite possible. But I also think if we were to have a person as a reviser, just say, so highly experienced interpreters would be the best people to do that because they would be able to pick up on the nuances, the little finer details, and all of that sort of stuff. But how do they get there? How do they get to that skill level? And that's living it, which now, just say, in 5 years, if that sort of hospital interpreter role, or even, I don't know, master court interpreter role comes up, but everything lower down is done in a more basic way with the AI being involved. How do those people then get their skills so sharp that they can kind of oversee this and be like, oh no, I'm the expert. This is wrong. This needs to be corrected, blah, blah, blah. Because new professionals coming into the field aren't going to get that real world experience that makes them so sharp and so skilled at what they do.
That's true. Yeah, really, really good point. Yeah, so there's a lot to be seen about it still, but I'm not scared. Are you scared?
I'm not, you know what? And people ask me that, and I say, listen, I'm in the process of leaving a full-time job with benefits to go 100% freelance. It's because I have faith in that I'm going to be able to find work in the near future until I decide to retire. And I don't think I'll probably ever retire just because, I love what I do. But I said, if I were more scared, I wouldn't have made this choice. And I also think I was listening to Bruce Adelson one time during a webinar he was giving, and he's so funny. But he said the reason why a lot of this in AI interpreting has not been implemented yet is because they can't figure out who to sue when something goes wrong. And I think it's much more complicated when you put in that liability layer in there and the legal repercussions of it. Things get a lot more complicated. It's just not communication. There's all this stuff that has to go on behind the scenes. And I've even been keeping an eye on some, comments on LinkedIn and things like that about now, if you punch in like a legal text into AI for it to translate it, now it has all these disclaimers that weren't there before. Like, this should not be taken as legal advice. You should consult a professional attorney. And that wasn't there before. So somebody somewhere was like, nope, this is wrong, this is, a big goof, and we need to at least let people be made aware of that they shouldn't blindly trust all of this. So, yeah.
One last thing on that I wanted to briefly mention, just as a resource. I don't know if you've seen it yet. It came out just a few days ago. IEEC, so the International Organization for Conference Interpreting, they put out a campaign about AI and interpreting. It's called Master the Message. So it's masterthemessage.ieek, which is AIIC.org, and it's really I really like it. And they put a lot of really good thought into it, and it kind of encapsulates a lot of these things. I'm trying to see if I can find a few of the nuggets, because I was looking at this the other day. So they have six principles of it. So, and it forms the acronym MASTER. So meaning, awareness, security, tone, engagement, and reliability.
That's great.
And
That
then
sounds
with
great.
those, right? And then with those principles, they kind of talk about it. So one of it was, human experts are expert, human interpreters are experts at reading in between the lines, picking up on the unspoken nuances of each speaker, understanding the cultural context, which can have a big impact on the intended message. And then say, while AI is clearly brilliant at processing huge amounts of data in a matter of seconds, it doesn't think like a human. It doesn't understand the subtle inflection of a voice. It doesn't bridge cultural divides. It doesn't ensure that the message is going to resonate. So, very, very much what you were saying. So it's a really nice piece. It's a good campaign. They talk about how we're the ones who can look for biases. We can foster the genuine in engagement, and we add that layer of emotional intelligence. And you can't you I don't I really truly believe that you can't communicate without that connection, without that human element. And that is, we as beings, we're unique to it, right? This the communicating through language, through the words, and this kind of vocalizing of language, we're very unique in it. It's very sophisticated, and it's very human.
It's innately human. And you can tell when you walk into a tense situation. Nobody has to say anything, but you can tell the minute you walk through the door, ooh, you're like, ooh. And there's no word uttered at all. But isn't that amazing how we pick up on those things?
And I think, AI, there is so much potential. They're already doing really good things, in things that we're not even, thinking about. I was interpreting for a group of people, and that was part of the things that they were exploring, was how to use AI in the for the electric grid. So all kinds of really interesting, really meaningful applications that, no human wants to do, needs to do. And the AI applications that use AI can really make it a lot better and a lot safer. Why try to apply this for communication? Like, let us be, as humans, not just interpreters and translators, but
So I have a theory about
let me hear
that.
it.
Well, first of all, you have all those tech bros, right? But my theory is that a lot of this AI for translation and interpreting is actually being pushed by monolingual people who, for some reason, think that language can be boiled down to code. To a certain degree, it can be, but I think a lot of the people who are pushing this in the, so for example, there's a lot of LSPs here in the United States whose founders do not speak a second language. They are not from the translating and interpreting environments. And for me, that is a huge problem because there's this fundamental piece that they're missing. And so I think, oh, well, we can just, boil this down to a bunch of, bits and, zeros and ones, and then we can translate it over. I think through some fits and bursts and trial and error and stuff, we're going to realize that, sure, it sounds good in theory, but at the end of the day, it doesn't really work that way. Humans don't really work that way. So leave the human communication to the humans. Yeah, if you have a appliance manual, how to work your microwave, great. Something that's sort of very a routine and repetitive and things like that. Yeah, nobody wants to be translating that. Translators don't even want that.
And even that is gone. I've noticed to a lot of iconography. Is that how you would say? A lot of icons,
Yeah,
instructions,
exactly.
just
It's
which
just,
makes more
yeah.
sense anyway.
I
You
know,
don't
because
even.
in and I'm like, we got a shelf. We ordered a shelf, came through this Amazon, it came to our door, and it's a little bit weird to set up. But even the translation of that was like pretty bad. And I was like, I bet you AI could have done this better. It's because they're probably just printing out the same translation that was done 10 years ago. But I was like, we're not even using AI for the stuff it should be using for, and then we're trying to push it on other things where it should just be like off limits. I don't
Well, we could clearly, I mean, as interpreters, right? We could go on for days. This is
Day,
really
weeks.
great. Thank you for all this. Let's get to the end, because I think we've
Okay.
been going for
I think we've been
probably a
going
good
for a long
hour.
time. I told you I like to talk, right?
No, this happens all the time. So let's finish off. We have two more things that I like to finish off. So the love what you do idea. So I, and I've heard you say it already, I feel r really lucky that I get to do this for a living. And where are you out with this? Do you still, I have a hunch of what how you're going to say this, but would you still pitch this profession to somebody who's in high school, college, or even somebody looking for that second, third career?
So if let's start at the end. So if you're looking for a second or third career and you have strong language skills, I would say definitely, because those skills that you have from your other professions or your other careers are going to transfer over. So I know a lot of people who come from finance, for example, and now they're in financial translation. A lot of people who come from legal fields and now they're in legal translation, engineering, sort of all of that stuff. So that would be a huge asset for you. If you are just starting out, you're in high school or you're in college and you're thinking about majoring, maybe you have strong skills in another language, I would actually recommend maybe not going into translation per se, because I think the dust will settle in a little bit, but I do think there are going to be a lot of jobs that have been lost already and they're not coming back. What I would say is think broader as to, for example, localization. The world is more and more global. Like there's a lot of project managers in localization, or even project managers in big companies that are so busy, and handling those projects that are related to language, different countries, different cultures, messaging, colors, like what colors should you be using in certain countries and what colors should you avoid? So that is something bigger, I think, where translation and interpreting will be a little piece of that, or like one ingredient in the bigger recipe for that. So that's what, if my son were to come to say to me today, "Hey, I'm thinking about getting in translation," I would say, "Great, that might be a good start for you, but think bigger. Just think a little bit bigger in language in general."
Yeah, and communication, right?
Oh, yeah.
As a larger field.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, so let's do our rapid fire here, lightning, the round finale. And it's funny because, again, this is restarting from 4 years ago when the podcast first started. So it'll be interesting to see if there are any changes here. So just which one is for you? So notepad or digital pad?
Notepad, 100%.
Coffee or tea?
I love coffee, but I can't drink it anymore because it really messes with my stomach. So I'm actually drinking a lot of matcha right now.
Ah,
But I smell
matcha.
coffee. Like if somebody has coffee, I'll just take a big whiff of it. And that's I feel like this is how people used to smoke. This is how they must feel.
Nice comparison with another vice. Yeah. What about for language learning? Are you a visual or auditory learner?
I for me personally, it's both. Like they're two sides of the same coin. I think of language learning as like riding a bike or driving a car. You have to do the pedals and you have to steer at the same time. It's not one or the other, in my personal opinion. I also think if you only learn language through your ear, you're missing out on so much. I think the reading and then the writing really helps cement what you're hearing through your ears.
And what about, is there anything that you take? Do you have a token or a special object that you take when you interpret?
My notepad. I like if I walk in without a notepad, I will actually ask a staff, like a front desk person or something, if I can just have a sheet of paper and a pen to borrow.
And freelancer in-house.
Yeah, that's a tricky time for me to answer that. They both have their pros and their cons. I've decided to go back to freelancing because of the flexibility and the freedom that it gives. But the in-house, the guaranteed income is also very nice.
Yeah, there are definitely advantages to both.
Yeah.
What about for mode? Do you consecutive or simultaneous? Do you have a preference?
So I'm mostly dealing consecutive, hardly ever simultaneous, and it's usually very exceptional situations. But I'm getting into simultaneous more now as I study for the court exam, the state court exam. Consecutive, I think, is a little bit different because you have to switch back and forth between the languages, whereas for simultaneous, you only go in one direction. So I don't know. I kind of like them both, but I'm mostly working consecutive.
And is there a term or just some kind of category or area that you always get stuck on for terminology?
Food. I can never, I hear new names of foods and like vegetables and fruits and stuff like that. And like I'll remember it for the rest of that interpreting session. And then I walk out and it's gone. And even if I write it down in my notepad, I don't remember it like the next day. So I'm constantly having to ask people to repeat themselves or explain what that is. And I don't know why it just does not stick. I probably have to eat it to print. For it to stick in my brain.
Yeah, that's like, well, it's they can be so different because I think, is it dragon fruit that in Portuguese is pitaya, I think, which is just totally different. You know, star fruit,
Yeah.
it just doesn't, and it may be, you know, those words that are so visual, you know, star, dragon, and then
Correct.
totally different in the other language.
Yeah.
Okay, finally, what's a favorite podcast?
So I love the En Pantuflas podcast. It's by two Argentine women and they are so funny and they're so like realistic and down to earth. That's in Spanish. And then the other podcast that I'm listening to currently, I go in sort of podcast immersions. So I like do a podcast, I'll listen to all the episodes and then I'll move on to another podcast. But the one I'm currently listening to is called The Huberman Lab. It's by Andrew Huberman. He's a neuroscientist. He's based out in California. I love learning how the brain works. And that's also, I think, comes from knowing how we interpret, because I think that's magic for a lot of us. We do it, we don't realize how we're doing it. If someone were to ask me, well, how exactly do you do it? I'd be like, I don't know. Same with translation. So that podcast, I just find it so fascinating about how the mind works, how the brain works. And then I'm like, oh, that's probably why I do that. That's probably why I do this other thing. So, and I think the more we become aware of how we work, then the better we're going to be kind of as human beings in our relationships with others.
Yeah, I love the Huberman Lab too.
Yeah.
It's a great one.
It's great.
In terms of podcasts, I'm the opposite of you. And it's just like I do with reading. It's like I listen to, you know, 10, 15 of them rotating. I was like, what am I in the mood for today? Okay, I'll go with that one.
Yeah.
But his is very good in terms of information, and it's
Yeah.
they're his guests are really good.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Jamie. This has been wonderful. Real pleasure. Thank you again for agreeing to do it and for helping me relaunch the podcast and this new season.
Well, thank you. No, this was so much fun. And I know this is going to be a great season for you as you get this up and running again. Looking forward to it.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, I'll see you soon.
Okay, goodbye.